All right, back at it with this latest installment of the Ellison Report, your weekly broadcast podcast hybrid magazine of politics, policy, and the people shaping them, here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm your host, Charles D. Ellison, no less than at the storied Morgan State University campus here in Baltimore, Maryland, in the WEAA studios. Catch me if and when you can at Ellison Report via Twitter or EllisonReport.com for more on our program, extra content from our guests, plus important data points discussed during this week's show. Find me in the pages of the Philadelphia Tribune as a Washington correspondent and also in the Root.com as a contributing editor and the Hill as well. With the Supreme Court set to hear oral arguments in the Fisher v. Texas case on December 9th, the fate of affirmative action in higher education is uncertain. That case may also create a new wrinkle in upcoming elections. New research just dropped by sociologist Sagal Alon finds that a race-neutral class-based system would actually reduce the number of African-American students in elite universities by as much as 50%. She writes that in her new book, Race, Class, and Affirmative Action, and compares affirmative action in U.S. society to affirmative action in Israel, which I found intriguing. So I had to have her join us by phone from Tel Aviv in Israel. Sagal, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So why the comparison between the U.S. and Israel for the basis of this study beyond your living in Israel? How did you see those similarities and similar racial dynamics at play? I spent a couple of weeks in Israel, so I did notice those racial dynamics, those tensions as well. And I want to kind of hear from you what sort of triggered that comparison.
Right. So Israel and the U.S. are very different countries, but there are also important similarities. In both Israel and America, economic inequality is on the rise. Stratification is both based on race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status. Mm-hmm. And a college degree in both countries is the engine for mobility and prosperity. And finally, when we look at the student body at elite institutions in both countries, we see that there is an underrepresentation of both minority students and underprivileged students. Mm. So given that, it's interesting that Israel and the U.S. embark on two different roads to affirmative action. In the U.S., we have a race-based model of affirmative action, and that is racial and ethnic minorities are getting an admission. The affirmative action in Israel is quite different because Israeli universities actually take into account student structural disadvantages by giving an edge in admission to applicants coming from poor neighborhoods or high poverty high schools. So basically, Israel is the only country around the globe that has class-based affirmative action.
Interesting.
So now, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court may shift our model of affirmative action from race-based to class-based, and we basically in the U.S. have no knowledge of how such a class-based model would work. So we have, I think, here a wonderful opportunity to examine the Israeli program and see how class-based affirmative action actually works, what are the pros and what are the cons of adopting such a model.
Hey, you know, I'm curious.
I want to emphasize that I'm not directly comparing Israel and the U.S., but
right.
Within each country, I'm comparing two models of affirmative action. So in the in Israel, I'm comparing the class-based affirmative action to a race-based or ethnicity-based affirmative action in which kind of Israeli Arabs and Jews who immigrated from or have Asian or African origin are mm-hmm. getting an edge in admission. And in the U.S., I do the opposite. I compare the current race-based model of affirmative action to a class-based affirmative action.
And if I'm real curious too, Sagal, What about the political discourse? Did you examine that, you know, how that kind of shapes whether or not we embrace a race-based model, whether or not Israel, how Israel embraced its own class-based model? How much does politics factor into that?
Right, yeah. So I do consider or at least speculate about this issue. In my opinion, I don't think, I mean, there are calls once in a while in Israel to have race-based affirmative action or ethnicity-based affirmative action. Mm-hmm. But I think because of political reasons, I think this model is not going to work. So I'm happy that we have this class-based model because actually Arabs are overrepresented among the beneficiary of affirmative action, although it is completely race neutral. Hmm. So they are benefiting from it, and we don't have the extra stereotypes and discontent that is associated with a race-based model.
Mm-hmm. And if students aren't getting admitted to elite universities, as you call them, what are the larger consequences, you think, for these societies if they're not embracing any sort of affirmative action model, whether it's race-based or class-based?
Right. So today, about 70% of high school graduates end up in college. And so the vast majority of them do not attend an elite institution. And today, any college diploma will still secure greater life chances. What seems to matter more today than in previous decades is the type of college you attend. That mm-hmm. is the prestige and the quality of the college. And I see three main benefits for attending an elite institution, and they are important in the context of the debate about affirmative action. So the first is an increase in one graduation likelihood. The odds of attaining a bachelor degree are affected by institutional resources, for example, endowment, financial aid, small classes, etc. And this is above and beyond students' own characteristics. Second, there is an increase in one's occupational status and future labor market earnings from attending an elite. An elite college. And finally, elite institutions provide the pathway for leadership positions. So from all these reasons, I think it is, when we talk about affirmative action, is to focus on elite institutions. This is the site where affirmative action is needed because these are very selective institutions, and they tend or they tend to pick up and choose the privilege for obvious reasons. So affirmative action basically allow underprivileged students, whether they are racial or ethnic minority or whether they are poor students, to get access to all those benefits.
Mm. And can you introduce a special circumstance model for college admissions without calling it affirmative action? Is that something that you looked at a little bit closely, or even acknowledging that they're special programs? I mean, they're just naturally baked into the admissions program of these universities, because it seems like affirmative action, it seems like such a, these days, in terms of the political rhetoric, it's such a volatile name. So I wonder if you looked at that as well in terms of how an electorate, whether it's in the U.S. or Israel, responds or reacts to that term, one, and two, maybe kind of doing away with the sort of traditional way that it's been described.
Right, yes. Actually, I do discuss this issue in the book quite extensively, mm-hmm. Because in theory, we can have such a general program without calling it affirmative action. And actually, we do have such programs at elite institutions. They call it holistic admission or call it a comprehensive review process. Mm-hmm. What does it mean is that they consider, this is what they say at least, they consider academic achievements in the context of the applicant's previous life chances. And let me give you a concrete example. In 2002, six of University of California campuses began to implement a comprehensive review process in their admission. And in that process, the evaluator are supposed to consider whether the applicant has faced hardship or usual circumstances and how he or she responded to them. And they also consider linguistic background, parents' education, and other indicators. So this sounds promising, right? Mm-hmm. One would expect, and you would expect, that we see an increase in the share of poor students in the U.S. Schools after implementing such a policy. So I decided to examine this question, and I tracked the undergraduate students at UCLA and UC Berkeley who received need-based financial aid, that is Pell Grant, from the government between 1998 and 2007. So 2002 was in the middle. Mm. And what the trend that we see is just a flat line. Nada. There is no change in the share of poor students attending UCLA and UC Berkeley as a result of this new admission policy. And this my conclusion is supported by other research who looked at the holistic admissions process at other elite institutions. And this is because, you know, these institutions, once you tell them consider other circumstances, what they basically look at is whether the student paid the violin and whether she participated in a mission trip to help HIV patients in Africa, et cetera, et cetera. They're looking for well-rounded students. And these are not the indicators. These are not indicators for underprivileged backgrounds. So, unfortunately, I think we have to call admission policies affirmative action and be more really clear about what these policies are supposed to do. What are the goals if we want to make a difference in the share of underprivileged students at these institutions?
Sagal Ilan, she is calling us from Tel Aviv University in Israel. Race, Class, and Affirmative Action is her book. It'll be coming out soon. I believe it's already out, correct?
Right, yes.
Yes, it is. And you can find that online. I'm trying to figure out where exactly you can find that online, Sagal.
Amazon.com?
Sagal Ilan.
Well, you can find everything, you know.
If you can find everything on Amazon, exactly. Sagal, thanks so much. It really was a pleasure catching up with you finally. And I definitely want to keep track of your research and follow up with you. Very much appreciate it. You take care.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you. Up next, it's the ER's good friend, Peter Groff, here to draw a little sense, if we can, out of the surreal state of the presidential campaign, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
Possession is the motivation, hanging up the whole damn nation. Looks like
welcome back to the Ellison Report, lactose-free people, politics, and policy. We're also made possible by support from underwriters like Oneness Mobility. Learn more at onenessmobility.com. Technical guidance and support from BE Strategy. More at strategybe.com. And don't forget about generous support from you, the public radio listener. More information on how you can support this endeavor by visiting weaa.org. Click on donate. It's been downright comical, albeit fascinating, to watch the presidential field unfold on the Republican side. But to many, the language on the campaign trail has taken a rather ugly turn in recent weeks since the attack on Paris, with candidates like Donald Trump either suggesting all Muslims in the United States should be put on a registry or pushing out neo-Nazi originated and woefully inaccurate crime stats about black people to mostly Republican governors, flat out rejecting Syrian refugees. Peter Groff, a former Obama 2008 co-chair and administration official, plus former president of the Colorado State Senate, joins us to offer his thoughts about the increasingly surreal state of the 2016 race. He's at Peter C. Groff on Twitter. Peter, thanks for joining us. This reminds me of quite a few sci-fi dystopic scenario films and TV shows where this sort of rhetoric doesn't come from a good place, and it doesn't end up in a good place either. But not just that. We've been here before, right? Whether it's Japanese Americans facing internment or European Jews right. facing genocide in World War II. What's giving someone like Trump the license to play with fire like that?
Well, Charles, thanks for having me back on the show. I appreciate it. You know, that's an interesting question, because while the media kind of reports these statements, they never go to the next step, which is interesting, because all basically we have now, and certainly cable news, is opinion folks who refuse to say this rhetoric is dangerous. Mm-hmm. And he's got to at some point stop this before he just gets way too far out on a limb. And Colorado would say he's way out over his skis. But it seems like each time he says something, he doesn't deny it. In fact, he doubles down on it. He doesn't double back. He doubles down on it. And the numbers continue to stay. It's really a fascinating and certainly dangerous period of time, I think, in our politics.
Mm. You're also a political historian. You lectured at the University of Denver for some time about politics. So what's your feel on how the electorate eventually evolves on this?
You know, I've stopped saying I don't think that he can get the nomination, he being Trump. But I still think the Republican Party, particularly the establishment part of the party, says we can have this guy be our nominee. He doesn't flip the map in any tangible sense. There's not one state I don't think that he can win with this type of rhetoric. But at some point, the party has to kind of fall in, or certainly the establishment part of the party has to fall in behind, whether it's a Senator Rubio or Governor Christie or somebody, to kind of offset what's going on the Cruz and Trump part of the party before it's too late. I mean, you're looking now, we are here late November. There's going to be this quiet time after probably, what, the next 2.5, 3 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
And then we are in a full sprint to November 2016, Iowa, and then in quick succession, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. Trump leads in all four of those states. At some point, somebody needs to step up before, I would say, South Carolina and say, hey, we're going to win this, and we're going to win it right here, and we're going to stop this.
You know what I found interesting, Peter? I was looking at some numbers recently. It was a YouGov poll, which was gauging public opinion on the Syrian refugee issue. And what I found rather compelling was about 35% of African Americans agreeing with the decision by governors, by about 24 governors now, last count, to reject Syrian refugees, which is not even really clear they can do that, because this is a federal thing, really.
Exactly. It's a federal issue. Correct.
Right. And I want to get on that in a minute. But I'm wondering, is that something that when you look at that kind of number, 35% of African-Americans on an issue like this, African-Americans should be kind of worried, too, about this creating a slippery slope, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, there's that saying with regard to World War II. First, they came for the socialists, and I didn't say anything. They came for the machinists, so I didn't say anything. And finally, they came for me, and there was nobody around to say anything.
Mm.
African-Americans need to be very, very careful on this issue, to give government even more power to discriminate based on what somebody is and where somebody comes from really has not worked out too well for us. And we're having the conversation now around the role of police and police brutality, based on who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And so African Americans, I think, need to be very, very careful on this, particularly when you look at the fact that the mastermind was from Belgium. We already have Syrian refugees in this country. Even France has said, despite the attacks there a couple of weeks ago, that they're going to still plan to bring in 30,000. There's a way to do it. And to do it in a way to make sure the terrorists are not coming through. It takes almost two and a half years to get through the American process. You know, this is just red meat and red herring created by the right to kind of stir up fear and try and change this election to be an election around foreign policy, because foreign policy elections, Republicans generally win.
Right. They pretty do well. And, you know, it's interesting because the current ISIS-fueled situation in Syria is not so much a Syrian thing. That's why Syrians are trying
exactly.
to flee.
Exactly.
They're trying to leave Syria. Reports show it's actually foreigners, especially Western-born jihadis, that go into Syria and create the sort of mess that we're seeing right now. Peter, and I, especially you as a former state legislator, a former leader in your state legislature, I'm curious if you're seeing any sort of troubling dynamics in terms of the federal-state relationship, because you have these, you have about over two dozen governors now rejecting or saying that they don't want Syrian refugees coming to their state, and they really can't do that because this is a federal program. And so here we go again with another big debate. I mean, we're having this big debate already with the Affordable Care Act, and now we're having it over something as sensitive as Syrian refugees and immigration. Does that create more troubling friction between the feds and also the states as well?
You know, Charles, I don't think so. I mean, I think there's always this natural friction.
Got it.
Between the federal government and state governments and who does what and who can do what. And generally, courts continue to say, the Constitution says, that the federal law will trump state law. And so, you know, the governors, while they're beating their chest, it's an empty boast because they can't do anything about it. They can certainly voice their opposition to the federal government, but at the end of the day, the federal government will determine how many refugees are allowed to come in and then where they'll be placed.
All right. Peter Groff, at Peter C. Groff on Twitter. You find him there. Thanks for joining us, man. We'll have you back on.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care. Up next, Migration Policy Institute's Kathleen Newland to discuss Syrian refugees and the future of immigration policy. More on that here on your weekly magazine for politics, policy, and the people that shape them, The Ellison Report, at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Welcome back to The Ellison Report, made possible by generous support from Oneness Mobility, OnenessMobility.com, as well as technical guidance and advisement from BE Strategy. StrategyBE.com. Joining us by phone is Kathleen Newland. She's co-founder and senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. More information at migrationpolicy.org and on Twitter at Migration Policy. Kathleen, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
All right. You must find these recent events a bit unsettling, not only the rejection of Syrian refugees, but a growing atmosphere of anti-immigrant sentiment permeating public discourse. How worried are you about this? And is this something a bit sort of unprecedented, at least in terms of modern politics? And this current climate pretty much shuts down any chance at comprehensive immigration reform, correct?
Well, I think at least until after the presidential election, it's unlikely that anything is unlikely to move in this atmosphere of sort of hyper-partisanship that we're operating in now. But for me, it's very sad and unfortunate to see the refugee resettlement program drawn into a partisan debate, because it's a program that has traditionally had very strong bipartisan support throughout the country, as well as a vigorous involvement of civil society in the United States.
And that bipartisan support, you know, obviously it's sort of disappearing here. And I mean, beyond, did you see sort of some friction on this refugee program even before the Paris attacks? Was this something that had been bubbling for some time?
Well, I think there has been some discontent with the program, mainly as a result of what states and municipalities have sometimes seen as a lack of communication from the federal government in terms of letting states and communities know when to expect refugees to arrive in their communities, you know, how many, where they're coming from, what their needs might be. And sometimes that's because the resettlement agencies themselves don't have very much information. But we've seen instances in the past, in 2010, 11, or 12, where states have complained about the refugee resettlement program, or asked the federal government to sort of have a moratorium on arrivals in certain communities. But that's always been on the basis of capacity to receive people rather than on the basis of security concerns. This is the first time I've seen concerns about the security implications of the program expressed, and it's hard to see any evidence that those concerns are really well-founded.
Hey, it's not like this current U.S. Immigration system is exactly the most welcoming or easiest to navigate in the world, right? So, and should I be making a distinction first, before I even go further with that question, between the immigration system and the refugee system? Are those two different things? Are they one and the same? Are they operating under sort of the same umbrella, or are they sort of separate kinds of channels here?
They're very distinct channels, and the refugee channel is governed by the Refugee Law of 1980, which formalized the systems that we have for resettling refugees in this country. Before 1980, we'd seen hundreds of thousands of Indochinese refugees resettled here after the end of the Vietnam War, but all under the parole authority of the president. So the Refugee Act of 1980 was a way of setting up a system, having a consultation with Congress built into that system, and just making the whole process more organized. There have been tweaks to the process since then, particularly in the last decade, to make the refugee resettlement channel more secure. And particularly since 9/11, and in the years following that, there have been tweaks to the program. We also need to distinguish between the refugee resettlement program, where we select and screen and invite people to come, versus the asylum channel, where people just arrive in the United States under their own power and apply for asylum. And only then do they go through the screening process. So the refugee resettlement program is the most secure, most heavily scrutinized way of entering this country out of all of the channels, whether it's tourists or business visitors or family visits or students. I mean, refugees are really heavily scrutinized, and the record, the security record on refugees is extremely good.
Now, proponents of legislation like the SAFE Act, which passed through Congress, they're saying that, you know, they don't want to shut the program down, right? They're just wanting to make it much tighter. They want tighter restrictions. They want to make sure that no one's slipping through the cracks. And so this isn't necessarily shutting the program down, but you're having issues with it as far as it could slow things down to the point where it's almost like a shutdown of the program?
I think it would be virtually a shutdown. It already takes 1 or 2 years or even longer, typical is 18 to 24 months, for a refugee to go through the whole process of being screened and processed to enter the country. So it's hard to see what additional levels of scrutiny would really produce any added value, because what we do now is already so rigorous. I mean, refugees are matched against 4 independent databases, which include both biometric information, you know, fingerprints and facial recognition, as well as biographical data, you know, what's their story, where have they come from, who have they associated with. And it is all that information is scrutinized by the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, the Department of Defense, and the National Counterterrorism Center. Now, tell me what more you want to make this a secure program. And the record shows how effective it has been since 9/11, when these security protocols were really tightened up. The U.S. has admitted 784,000 refugees. That's a lot. And in that time, only a tiny handful, maybe 4 or 5 people, have been arrested on terrorism-related charges. Only one of them was even thinking about an attack in the United States, and all had their plans disrupted by the FBI and law enforcement long before they could put anything into effect. So there has never been a terrorist event in the United States carried out by a resettled refugee.
Hey, real quick question here, Kathleen, last question. In your assessment or in your analysis over time, where does old-fashioned American-style anxiety over migrants stem from in the first place? Is it always race, or is it the state of the economy, a mix of both?
Well, it's anxiety about immigration generally has been a feature of the Republic pretty much since its founding. You know, mm-hmm. Benjamin Franklin complained about all these German refugees, German immigrants coming to the 13 colonies, you know, and thought they would never be assimilated. Well, today we have something like 75 million Americans of German ancestry who are extremely well, you know, integrated, to say the least.
Right.
And, you know, I think it's just a kind of an instinctive reaction to be suspicious of people who are different. But once we are exposed to them and, you know, understand who they are, then that suspicion tends to dissipate. And the record of the U.S. as a nation of immigrants is a very good record of integrating people, including immigrants and refugees from the Middle East. You know, the Syrian American population, while small, is a very highly educated, professional, relatively prosperous group of people. And there's no reason to think that Syrians who are arriving now as refugees would be any different after time has elapsed.
Kathleen Newland, Migration Policy Institute, has been joining us. Hey, thank you, Kathleen. I've got to have you back on to follow up to kind of see what's been happening as this crisis unfolds. So
I would love to do that.
That would be great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with polling expert Susan McManus here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Welcome back to the Ellison Report, made possible by generous support from Oneness Mobility, OnenessMobility.com, as well as technical guidance and advisement from BE Strategy, StrategyBE.com. In light of recent upsets in elections, such as the recent Kentucky gubernatorial race, pollsters have been getting a lot of heat for bad outcomes and outdated methodology. Here to talk about the future of the industry is Professor Susan McManus, political scientist and polling expert at the University of South Florida. At Dr. McManus on Twitter. Also, more info online at usf.edu. Thanks so much, Professor, for joining us. Really appreciate this. Despite all the shade thrown at polling, we still need polling, right? So we use it quite a bit. Polls make or break campaigns and cry foul about, you know, all the inaccurate data. And, you know, we still actively use it. So what exactly is the problem with it?
Well, there are several problems. Of course, one of the big ones is the fact that we have cell phones. So many people have cell phones and not landlines.
Mm-hmm.
And related to that is the fact that a lot of people have caller ID so that they can easily screen out a call that they don't want to take time or are suspicious of taking. So the technology is one of the reasons. But a second reason is really the fact that some people are a little bit leery of giving information over the phone to someone that they don't quite know who it is or how they're going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of these polling firms use these, labels that seem like they're, you know, mom and apple pie. And when asked to be more, you know, definitive of who they are, they're a little bit hesitant to call the interviewer. And so people are thinking, well, who's going to get a hold of this data? Because right now, of course, there's a lot of concern about identity theft. I think that's a new development
recently.
And then a huge problem for a state like Florida and a lot of other diverse states is language. In Broward County alone, which is the Fort Lauderdale, southeast Florida part, right now in the Broward County public school system, there's 184 different languages spoken from 198 different countries.
Wow.
And a lot of pollsters, particularly phone interviewers, are not able to really accommodate the language differences, number one, and number two, the nuances of language. And I'd say number three, some of the cultural differences and political differences that make some questions just seem just totally unintelligible to someone who has not have a long history of American politics or policy.
So we just need a different kind of polling. We don't necessarily need to do away with polling. We need a different kind of polling. So what's that new polling look like?
Well, there's two kinds of polls, and I think increasingly, instead of these horse race polls, which are often the ones that are wrong, they're done in a hurry, they're done with small sample sizes, which many of them would fail Statistics 101, at least in my class. And, you know, but there is another need for something besides horse race polls, and it is also related to campaigns, and that is public policy polls with larger samples so that you can actually break down the responses so that if I am polling Florida like we do at the University of South Florida, Nielsen, Sunshine State Survey is a huge annual public policy survey of adult Floridians. So recently we asked them about how they felt about the economy, what they thought were the biggest environmental problems in Florida, things that people are willing to speak on and have a little bit more knowledge of and worry less about someone finding out their opinions about, other than who they're going to vote for and who they're leaning towards.
Which kind of, that's interesting that you say that. I mean, there's always been this long discussion or debate about campaigns being too cosmetic, you know, that it being more about the candidate than being about the issue. So it's interesting that you raise that. And real quick, as far as what the ideal sample should be, I mean, in your mind, what's the ideal number of respondents? And is that based on whether it's a local, state, or federal election?
In Florida, we don't like to use anything less than 1,200 because of breaking things down by, you know, race and ethnicity. Florida is one of the most diverse states in the country. And I really don't like to do even county surveys, which have diverse, a little bit less diverse populations. But I have to break it down by education and income and other things that are useful to policymakers. I don't like to do any of those, really, for under 800. So I feel comfortable doing larger sample size, a margin of error is smaller, and when I actually break down the data or my students break down the data into these very important categories that are useful to public policymakers and people running for office, you have more confidence in the results, and you end up with far less egg on your face when all is said and done.
Are the outcomes more accurate when it's a more localized poll or if it's, you know, as opposed to state or national polls?
The number is more irrelevant than the sample composition. You need to make sure that your sample is representative of, you know, if you're doing a national poll and, you know, regions of the country, accounting for differentials in size. You know, I might want to look at geographic makeup, rural, urban, suburban, and, you know, education, income, ethnicity, all those things. If you want your sample to look like whatever entity it is, the nation or the state or the local, it's the composition of the sample that's more important than is the actual just sheer number. But you still have to have a large enough sample size that when you break things down that you have a margin of error that's tight and you have more confidence in the results. Otherwise, this is what's happening in polling. A lot of people and firms are doing it on the cheap. They're doing small sample sizes just to make headlines in the newspaper. And then when the results are way off base, everybody says, oh, polling's going to the dogs, so to speak. And it really is a lot of people cutting corners when they shouldn't just to get a headline.
Interesting. Yeah, we had a recent poll in Baltimore, actually, for its Democratic primary coming up on April 26th, just released, Baltimore Sun, University of Baltimore. Fewer than 400 respondents on that poll. So already that pollster is coming under a lot of fire because they're like, city of 600,000, you only find less than 400 people to respond to that poll. One last question, too, Professor. It's interesting because prospective or active voters seem inclined to give campaigns digital information or social media data that can be used for what we're calling micro-targeting these days, yet they don't want to be polled. You described that privacy issue earlier on. Is it also just a case of polling fatigue on the part of voters? They don't like polling because it's an extension of what they feel is a corrupted political process.
Well, it's certainly some of that, but it's also fatigue because particularly when you're talking about telephone polling, the average person is just bombarded with telephone calls from political people, from charitable organizations, from sales organizations. So if they see a number they don't recognize and somebody wants to take a poll and it's a telephone call, they'd just rather not, and they just hang up or they don't answer to begin with.
Right, right. Susan McManus, professor of political scientist at University of South Florida. Thanks so much, Professor. I'm sure we're going to talk to you again.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you.
All right. Take care. At your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're now back at the Ellison Report. In her recent piece featured in TheConversation.com, University of Texas social anthropologist and postdoctoral fellow Naomi Reed asks, are Texas textbooks making cops more trigger-happy? In an intriguing analysis that somehow navigates a controversial linkage between the disappearance of Black history in many school textbooks and the treatment of African Americans in the here and now. Reed is here to talk about that. She could be followed on Twitter at Beth Writes. Good to have you with us, Naomi. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, so some might make the argument that your claim is a bit of a stretch, but you draw on a fairly deep assessment of major textbooks and past research on the topic. What prompted you to make that linkage between textbooks on moments in Black history and modern police violence in the first place? Most would have never thought of that connection.
Okay, so much of my research came out of reading pretty closely an advanced placement textbook called The American Pageant.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the quotations in there around Black people or areas where you'd expect to hear a narrative about Black people ended up being more of a narrative around white working class individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So as the quotes, like the quotes showed in the op-ed, they were, you know, a story of white oppression rather than a story of Black oppression. So white racial epithets rather than, you know, all of the laundry list of things that Black people were called at the time, or, you know, fear around Nat Turner rather than, you know, oppression and people being whipped and these kind of things that we know happened in slavery. And that sort of narrative kind of went throughout the whole text. And I labeled that elsewhere a white redemptive narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, the first time I saw that sort of manifested in the real world, I guess, was with the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman situation,
mm-hmm.
Largely because of the way the language around the things that he was saying and things that he was doing versus some of the other major players of color in that trial, like Rachel Gentile, Trayvon Martin himself, the ways in which people were describing those individuals versus him, the way that he was talking about the situation sounded a lot like, you know, the way things were described in textbooks. So we come away with a sort of very contextualized idea of George Zimmerman. We know that his mother is a Latina, right? We know all of the issues he dealt with in the community, with supposedly with people robbing those homes. But we get very little about, you know, the details of those other individuals, the fact that Rachel Gentile was, you know, trilingual or Haitian or whatnot. You know, we didn't get any of that. It was this,
right,
this very pathologic image of those individuals and this very contextualized image of George Zimmerman. And we see the same thing with Darren Wilson, right? We don't get to hear how traumatizing it is for Mike Brown's, you know, community that he's lying in the streets. Instead, we get to hear all the fear or whatnot that went on with Darren Wilson, which may or may not have been the case. The point is, that's the narrative that gets to describe the death of a Black male.
Right.
Right?
Why did you single out Texas textbooks? Sort of describe that connection more in terms of why Texas textbooks are so important.
Mm-hmm. Well, for one, I was educated in Texas.
Right. Right.
but also. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, Texas has, I mean, there's many reasons, and we could talk about that at another time. Texas has a lot of control over how other states adopt textbooks. You know, this specific text, you know, The American Pageant is actually an advanced placement textbook, so I know for a fact that is used across the nation. But I think the focus on text, a lot of it came from the fact that a lot of the publishing happens here, and also, you know, my own personal interests. I'm housed in a policy institute that focuses on issues of education policy in the Black community. So,
So, you know, there's a lot of discourse now which suggests this generation, millennials, like, for example, when we're watching protests at the University of Missouri. A lot of people sort of assuming that millennials are more racially sensitive than their parents or grandparents, or especially white millennials, especially when you see images of white millennials and black millennials coming together, that they're much more racially adaptable, if you will. So, but if they're learning through the kind of curriculum that you described, that a lot of our kids are seeing, that omits key facts about slavery and black suffering, that doesn't bode well for the future of race relations, does it?
Right. No, not at all. And actually, it's sort of creating, I think, a really troubling sort of manifestation of, you know, it's creating a political manifestation that is making things happen and making people move. But I feel like millennials have so much anger because the sort of progression of entitlement, I would say, has evolved over time. Like, you're right, there is a generation gap. For example, my own father, you know, was more of that generation of do the best that you can and sort of, you know, change things within the system kind of approach, versus over time, like myself and Generation X folks, we're sort of like, no, like, things should change to work for me. And I think that sort of evolved more so with millennials. They feel entitled to success and access, and there's all this social media that's sort of showing them all these things that are happening that are not fair, that that don't fit well with that sort of notion of entitlement. And I think when you don't have the proper context of what's happened historically, it's hard to make sense of why that's happening, right? If people are sort of like spewing ideas of inferiority at you, and you know that it feels wrong, right? But you don't have like the language or the historical evidence to sort of push back against it, that can be very frustrating. Mm-hmm. And I think that's more of what's happening. I think a lot of people might say, you know, people absorb these messages, and certainly I think students along the way do absorb these messages and become discouraged or lack of confidence, but I don't think that lasts very long. I think millennials are like, no, I'm supposed to be successful. And so it's just a bubbling up of frustration that I think we're seeing, and people are looking towards social media as a way to act out.
Yeah, it is demoralizing. And it's funny, you know, you have that that evolution of material and textbooks happening at the same time. We got this explosion of information online. So it's easier to access information, but then, you know, the information in the classroom that's officially sanctioned for the classroom is so limiting in terms of its perspective, deliberately limiting in terms of its perspective. And I find that very fascinating. I've got you for another 30 seconds, Naomi. So you talk a bit about how whites perceive, react to characterizations of blacks throughout history. So what about blacks themselves? This has got, who are being exposed to the same material. It's got to be frustrating. I think you described that you hinted at that about a few minutes ago.
I mean, I think most, at least many black Americans go through a sort of like discovery of their blackness, especially since we're sort of the population that is always sort of our authenticity is interrogated, you know, in whatever form. And so I think perhaps maybe at a younger age or at some point, a less conscious point, so to speak, we might absorb these notions of inferiority, these pathologic things about laziness and aggression or whatnot, and maybe even start to believe those things. But as we sort of develop and get more information, there's a moment of frustration that I think is not sort of dealt with until we have the proper information. Until we're, you know, because our peers will say things like, well, you know, why didn't African Americans revolt against slavery? You know, the Greeks did it, or this and that. And then you hear about, you know, the Haitian Revolution that you don't learn about in school, right? Mm-hmm. And there's sort of like a very, I think in terms of like mental health, a very calming moment when you realize, no, this is not true. You know, people have fought, and these sort of critical ideas that I know, that I feel are probably true about my people are the case, but we're not getting it out of textbooks. It's like you have to seek it elsewhere. Like, I personally didn't come to this knowledge base until I went to graduate school for African diaspora studies, you know? Didn't get that in public school in Texas. And I think a lot of people are in need of that discussion. And I think the textbooks are just making it harder to get to it.
All right. Naomi Reed, University of Texas in Austin, @BethWrights on Twitter. Keep us posted on your next research, Naomi.
Okay, I will. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Take care.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be right back here on the Ellison Report talking to Stefan Henkin next, Democratic pollster and founder president of Lincoln Park Strategies. More on that here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Stefan Henkin is a Democratic pollster and founder president of Lincoln Park Strategies. More on that outfit at lpstrategies.com or follow them on Twitter at lpstrategies for some solid insights on the latest in campaign trends. Thanks for joining us, Stefan. Appreciate it.
Great to be here.
You wrote a recent piece in Campaigns and Elections magazine titled Lessons from a Fading Frontrunner, in which you detect early signs of the possibility that Donald Trump could lose his top spot at some point. We've been riding on this narrative of Trump's invisibility based on current polling. So obviously your view is kind of anti-conventional wisdom. Where did you see the first signs of fading?
It's been a couple of weeks now, and you know, I want to be careful and say fading is relative. He's still in the lead, and he still has both Trump and Carson in New Hampshire, Iowa too, are certainly ahead of the pack. But you know, that being said, what we're seeing in our data is that the strong supporters, the people who are really behind the candidates, are starting to move away from Trump. So you know, the folks that were just real diehard are now starting to wane. And you know, this could be the start of the decline. And I think a lot of people have been sort of assuming that this was going to happen at least a few months ago, although he's been riding high in the polls. But we are seeing that shift in his support, where it's not necessarily being picked up in sort of the conventional polling, but internally we're seeing that his support is weakening, and those voters are much more likely to be moving to other candidates over the next few weeks.
Hey, explain a bit how your notion of trendency research, that's what you call it, what you all do over there at LP Works, and what distinguishes that from the average analysis? Why is that distinction important, especially in this case?
Sure. So for Trendency, it's an online research platform, and what we're doing is we're taking algorithms and predictive analytics that were developed in research labs, and we're applying them to human behavior. And what we're doing is we're not just doing a poll one week and doing a poll next week. We're tracking individuals over time. So we're talking to the same 500,000 people sort of on a regular basis. So it's not just, oh, we see Trump lost 2 points. We'd say we saw these 10 people move away from Trump and move to Carson, or we saw these 20 people go from being a solid Trump supporter to a weak Trump supporter. So what this is doing is it's giving us the ability to start seeing trends before they happen. And you know, then before that, it's really getting picked up in public polling. And public polling, and I'm not disparaging public polling, it's what we do, but it's a very binary approach. So you either are a Trump supporter or you're not. You know, you're a supporter of Obama or you're not. And we view the data differently, where you know, a solid Trump supporter, 100% Trump supporter, is very different from a 60% Trump supporter because of the way their behavior is likely to play out over the next month or so.
So you like the Minority Report of polling?
We're trying to be.
Trying to be right. Yeah, and so the trend that you're seeing is when Trump people fall off, they're moving more towards Carson, Marco Rubio. What are some of the other candidates that you see maybe ranking them in most folks trending towards them? Where are those voters going?
Yeah, so it's really interesting, and we're seeing different things in different states. So in Iowa, the voters who are moving off of Trump are actually moving towards Carson and vice versa. They're actually a whole bunch of voters who are sort of ping-ponging between those two candidates, which is bad news for the Ted Cruz of, or not, or for Ted Cruz, because you know, I think he's trying to, I believe, you know, bank on picking up their supporters. But right, until they actually leave those two candidates, it's not really going to help him too much. In New Hampshire, it's actually getting much murkier, according to our data, where voters are moving off Trump. They're moving, you know, a little bit off Carson, and then they're just spreading out. So we're seeing Rand Paul move up a little bit. We're seeing Christie go slightly. And then the one candidate who's just not quite connecting yet, even though in regular polling, you know, we're seeing his numbers rise, is Rubio, where people see him as a potential winner, but they're just not buying into his campaign yet. So he's got a long way to go, even though, you know, he's starting to get a little bit higher numbers in your conventional polling. We're just not seeing the Republican primary voters buying into his campaign in a meaningful way that is actually going to help him on Election Day if this trend continues.
Hey, Stefan, and I've got you for about another minute. One thing I've noticed in looking at the deeper crosstabs on Trump polling is the type of demographic that strongly supports him. It's the largely not college educated and also blue collar voter. Does that type of support cohort for Trump suggest that his polling supporters are less likely to actually come out and vote? Because just traditionally, those, you know, who are sort of low income, those who are less college educated, don't turn out as much as those in the middle class and those college educated.
Yeah, I think if we were looking at the general election, I would absolutely agree with you that that this would be troublesome for him. But since we're dealing with the primary electorate, and especially on the Republican side, you know, I mean, this is the Republican Party, and this is who turns out for Republican primary. So I don't think he has much to worry about there. What seems to be, and I've been saying this for the last few months, but at some point in time, it seems like he should say something crazy enough to just completely turn people off. But I don't know what is left in for him to say that to move people away. But I think it's more, you know, right now it's still his race to lose, although he is starting to lose it. But it's just, you know, can he run out the clock until Iowa? And, you know, if he can pull off Iowa, then that can start changing the picture and what happens in New Hampshire and so on and so forth. So, you know, he's got to at least keep it close in Iowa. I mean, if he wins it, that changes the dynamic a little bit of what happens in New Hampshire. But, you know, it is murky. And I think anyone who stands here and says today, I know who's going to win the Republican convention, you should walk away from, because you shouldn't trust them.
Stefan Hankin, Lincoln Park Strategies at LP Strategies on Twitter. Hey, good to have you on, Stefan. Thanks so much, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll be talking to you again. That wraps this week of the Ellison Report, all made possible by generous support from Oneness Mobility. More information at onenessmobility.com. Strategic advice and technical support provided by BE Strategy. Strategy, research, communications. More information at strategybe.com. Keep us on your watch list at Ellison Report and read analysis at ellisonreport.com. Till next week, stay safe, stay aware, and stay constantly tuned in to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.